from Wall Street to the White House. This is the Larry Kudlow Show on 77 WABC.
Welcome back, folks. Larry Kudlow, WABC in New York. Great pleasure. It's time to look at the stock market. It's time to make some money. This is the Make Some Money segment, I guess. And we welcome David Bahnsen, founder and managing partner of the Bahnsen Group. And we welcome Don Luskin, the chief investment officer of Trend Macro, two old friends. So, gentlemen, one thing you could do. Now, I'm, of course, very, very fearful of what's going to happen on the tax front, which I think is going to create considerable tax drag and economic drag and profits drag if and when that takes place. I find one really positive thing this week, The unions got clobbered in Alabama at the Amazon warehouse union vote. About, 71-25. So that's very good because Biden's pro-union agenda. I'm not against private unions, by the way, but private unions, too, have become dominated by their left-wing leaders, if you will. And so I don't have any use for them. But I don't see much else. All the talk about the budget and taxes and the PPI was very, very high. So everybody's screaming about inflation. I'm not sure I buy that yet either. But I'll let David Bahnsen tell me why the market went up 647 points on the Dow, 420 points on the NASDAQ, and 109 points on the S&P. The S&P is now 4,128.80. Now, that is a very cool number. The Dow's not so bad either, 33,800. These are just like interplanetary numbers. All right, David, why is this all happening?
Well, if you remember, the market was closed last Friday for Good Friday, and that was when you had the big employment number that came. And then you had a just fantastic ISM manufacturing, and later this last week, ISM services. Larry, you know this. The economy is doing great. Mm-hmm. It's opening. We're, the vaccine's working. All the Operation Warp Speed successes are working their way through. And so the corporate profit expectations are going higher, and corporate profits are the mother's milk. And so the market's pricing that in. Is it getting a little high? Well, it's more than a little high in some sectors. Others are still kind of playing catch up. But I think the market is just reflecting a lot of economic optimism.
Don Luskin, I give you a whack at it. Another fabulous week in stocks. Really fabulous week. Look, I'm long the indexes, so I'm fine with it. I'm not selling yet. But there are, you know, there's some storm clouds over the horizon. Anyway, you go ahead. Why is the market so strong and euphoric?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, Larry, make me a promise. Let me go first next time, okay? Because I'm going to say basically most of the same things that David just said. You know, the economy's opening up, but it's more than just a recovery. It's a boom. We've had a year of deferred consumption and deferred human fellowship that's been accompanied by the largest accumulation of savings in the history of the world. At the same time, yeah, so it's been stimulus payments. It's been unemployment benefits that were paying people 25% more not to work than to work, and now they're able to work again. So this is going to be like when World War II is over. And Rosie the Riveter loses her job, but that's a good thing because the world's at peace. And now she doesn't have to buy beef with rationing tickets anymore. She can cash in her war bonds, get into a whole new cycle of household formation. And, you know, that's what creates epical economic cycles. This is completely unique. And I want to remind you that the economic profession, which is full of horrible, wrong macroeconomic predictions, the worst one it ever made was in 1945 when it was unanimous consensus that after World War II, the United States was going to fall right back into the Great Depression of the 1930s. And that's what everyone's saying now. It's just the damn wall of worry. But what we in fact have is a wall of money. Now, I am not an oblivious idiot. You know, I know that there is certainly a chance that there will be higher taxes, maybe some, you know, very inefficient growth, corrosive taxes. But let's say that means instead of having a 10% real GDP year, we have an 8% real GDP year. You know, I mean, I'm going to regret that. That 2% would put a lot of well-being in a lot of households, but 8%, man, that'll still be a record.
You're right. I know you're right. I know Bonson's right. I agree. It just seems too good. I mean, actually, the best thing I've heard is that, as you noted, Donald, the economics profession is bearish. So right there, I should be very bullish and just stick with that. No, that's a very important point because they've all gone left-wing beyond Keynes, left-wing socialist. So there you have it. David Bonson, though, it's funny. When everybody is bullish, if you look back in investing history, if everybody is bullish, it's usually a danger sign.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that I am a pretty natural contrarian as well. And yet, when you look to some of the indicators, you still have had hundreds of billions of dollars flow into bond funds, not equity funds. A lot of the contrarian indicators are not out of control. Some are problematic. But, you know, there's one thing that both Don and I probably forgot to mention in all the different factors that explain market behavior this last week. And that is Joe Manchin coming out and saying, you're not getting a 28% corporate tax rate. Now, look, I don't want 25 either, but I think on the margin it points to something I've talked to you about a few times, Larry, and that is a lot of the stuff the Biden administration says, they're going to get a modified version of it, not the market worst-case version of it. And so let's say he ends up getting his infrastructure bill and he raises some taxes, but it's less than what the market had been worried about. You end up getting a 24, 25 corporate rate. That's higher than 21. That's not as supply side as you and I want, but it's not 28, and it sure as hell isn't 35.
At 25 plus state, we would be the number one highest corporate tax rate in the developed world. Just saying. Tax Foundation just did these numbers.
Yeah.
You got to add on 4.7% average for the states. That plus 25. In other words, it ain't that great. We're losing ground.
Larry, you poor naive fellow. Don't you know that Moody's Analytics says that all this is going to create 18 million new jobs?
Oh, I know.
There you go. Okay, so end of argument.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. you've got the Wharton-Penn model says going to lose jobs, knock out a percent of GDP, which is a lot, and take down wages. The Tax Foundation model is saying the same thing. And the National Association of Manufacturers just did one, a couple of economists from Rice University. Same thing. You're going to lose ground. You're not going to get growth. You're not going to get jobs, just the reverse. So I know it only seems like a few points, but we're going wrong direction. And this business about the global minimum tax at 21% is a terrible body blow, really terrible body blow to profitability and competitiveness. So I think David Bonson is way – there's irrational exuberance here on how this story is going to turn out. I know Joe Manchin, he's a good man, but he's not going to save it. He's going to vote for a big corporate tax hike. All right. He may not vote for the biggest one on the block, but he's going to vote for a big one. That's all I'm saying, David.
No, and I agree with you, but I think that we're talking about market prices. And so these are marginal realities. In other words, we can be against any movement higher in the marginal rate, and you and I both are. But a 20% increase is more severe to markets than a 10% increase, or whatever the numbers end up being. And you're right, those state rates get added in and make the marginal burden higher, but those state rates are already there. So we're talking about the incremental differences to corporate profits and to incentives. And I think that incremental difference is going to be really, really dumb, a really bad idea, but less than what Biden has threatened us with because of the 50-50 Senate. So I'm not being exuberant about it. I'm just sort of, you know, well, first of all, I'm a happy warrior at heart. I can't help it. But I'm just trying to point to a little half-full part of the glass here.
Don Luskin, what'd you make of the labor defeat in Alabama?
Oh my God, my hands are sore from applauding so much. Look, I think everybody. I think that's you were first talking about that in the setup at the top of the hour. It made me think that really maybe the message of the moment is that while the Biden administration and the media that's part of his ecosystem is pushing all the, you know, the virtue of this extremely progressive agenda, the reality is that the American people, even the Democrats, they elected Joe Biden. They didn't elect Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Elizabeth Warren. The 50-50 Senate, that's just because of 14,000 votes in one state. The right now, all it would take is flipping three seats in the House to defeat any bill that goes through the House. America is a perfectly 50-50 divided world. And to the extent that the Democrats try to overplay that, they are to that very same extent setting themselves up for absolute doom in 2022. Now, they aren't stupid. They know that. So there are lots of senators, there are lots of congressmen on the Democratic side of the aisle who are not going to let this thing go crazy.
Well, that's the thing, Don. I agree. The stock market is smart, and it contains all available information. So this shift to this far leftism, far, far leftism, you know, could guarantee a GOP Congress next year. And that is very bullish. Only thing on that scenario that concerns me is what do they get through in the meantime? You know, because Democrats are, they're probably smarter at playing these inside baseball games and Republicans, and they're going to use 51 vote records.
May I just interject that we should remember the lesson from history on that, Larry, which you know, you're right. Obama knew he only had two good years, mm-hmm. you know, 2009 and 2010, mm-hmm. and he rammed through Obamacare and Dodd-Frank, two of the biggest footprint pieces of legislation, and neither of them have been really been able to be pried loose 10 years later.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's the way Democrats think. David Bonson, you reading the stories yesterday and today, this morning, editorials about Mr. Biden's Supreme Court Reform Commission? Have you read those stories? If I can be blunter, it's called court packing, basically. What do you think of that?
Oh, I think it's more signaling and posturing to the far left. National Review put up a great editorial response to this. It's kind of like almost every single thing that President Biden's done since he got in. He's, at least in rhetoric, tried to give a nod to the most extreme, most progressive parts of his party. And then in some places he's put teeth on it with executive orders and that silly infrastructure bill and that silly COVID bill. So it's not good. It's not good what we're getting out of the West Wing. And Biden had an opportunity to basically come in and make a whole bunch of moderate independents really happy. And he didn't do it. Mm. And so I think that the positive side is exactly what you just said, and I think Don alluded to it. 2022 has the opportunity to be an incredible year for the Republicans because they can change legislation and they can change executive orders, but they cannot change the country. Mm. The country is not there on court packing and D.C. statehood and through the roof capital gain and corporate taxes. Mm. They're not there.
Let's switch back to the economy. Don Luskin, you had this PPI number come out. I'm not convinced there's a big inflation surge. Some people are. I'm not quite there yet because the dollar is still holding up pretty well. But what's your read? We're going to get CPI. I guess we get a batch of numbers next this coming week, Don. We get retail sales, CPI. I'm going to guess industrial production. What do you think?
Oh, I'm on the inflation side. Big, no, surge, won't deserve that word. But, you know, we've been through 12 or 13 years since the global financial crisis when every central bank in the world has struggled to try to get inflation up to 2% and has not been able to maintain it for more than a month or two. So if we were to get for, you know, say 6 months to 2.5%, the media, which, you know, makes its money by getting you all scared and excited, is, you know, certainly make a big deal out of that. You know, that's not exactly a secret. They're already making a big deal about it. Jerome Powell has been front-ending it by saying he fully expects it and intends not to react against it. So remember, you know, one of the, you know, the first order worst things that happens when you get a bump in inflation is often central banks get very skittish about that and they move too rapidly, too preemptively without really seeing the whites of their eyes, and they use this sort of stupid old Phillips curve logic to, you know, slow down the economy because it's overheating. Oh my God, oh my God. And, you know, the great thing is Jerome Powell has just said in advance, I'm just not going to do that. So the first risk is taken right off the table. Now, the second risk is that we would look back on it in the fullness of time and say, oh, my God, the central bank should have intervened, but they didn't. Okay, well, maybe, but, you know, we'll deal with that problem 2 years from now. So if I'm reading your vibe right, Larry, I think we're in the same camp. I'm just not that worried about it.
Yeah, but David Bunson, market interest rates, I know they stopped rising in recent weeks after a nice bulge, but, you know, if you get 10% growth in 2021, which we could get, you know, maybe more conservatively 7 to 8%, but it's going to be big. Nominal GDP is going to grow a lot. You don't need a big inflation number to get there. Wouldn't that push, let's say, the 10-year rate up quite a bit?
Well, the problem is that the long rate is not going to respond at the end of the year to what took place in the post-COVID recovery. It's going to respond to longer-term expectations of growth, which are stunted by excessive government spending and stupid government policies, like tax increases and other things like that. We had 3.1% real GDP trendline growth for 50 years, and we've not been able to get it back since the financial crisis, except for when there were supply-side tax cuts and deregulation coming out of the White House and some really smart people at the National Economic Council. I won't say who some of those may have been. So, Larry, this is the problem, that we can't get this higher bond yield because we can't get our growth back to where it needs to be. We have a 1.65 10-year, and people are talking about inflation. I know Don and I feel the same on this issue. It's so stupid that it boggles the mind. We do not have runaway inflation, and the reason we know that is because the bond market's telling you. Moving up from 1% to barely over 1.5% is just reflecting a little bit of the good news of economic growth. And to his point, Jay Powell does get this, and what the Fed also now gets, that Greenspan resisted for a long time and Bernanke resisted, but now they have it programmed in their soul. If we ever get inflation, Paul Volcker told us what to do about it. But if we get deflation, none of us know what the hell to do about it.
Interesting. Conservatives are so split on this. I'm reading Larry Lindsay and Kevin Hassett, to some extent Ed Hyman, who's not really a political guy, but he's a conservative thinker. They're quite worried about inflation. Maybe transitory. Or worse, I've spoken to some of my former colleagues in the Trump administration who are, they're not worried about 8 or 10% inflation, but they are worried about 4 or 5% inflation, which would be a quantum jump. It's just interesting to me, all people are split on this issue. Don Luskin, to make us some money, what would you recommend to our listeners in this euphoric environment?
Oh, well, I think what I would do is I would try to get a little, you know, focus the microscope down a little bit and look for those parts of the market that aren't euphoric. You know, clearly, bonds aren't euphoric. Nothing euphoric about a, you know, 165 10-year yield. So, you know, so if you think that there's more euphoria to come, find the parts of the market that aren't reflecting it, assume they will, and take advantage. So that would mean, you know, find some way to stop owning those bonds or short them if you can. Try to find sectors that haven't completely recovered yet. Transportation, lodging, energy. You know, those are the ones where these stocks are still acting like there's a depression on because it has been a K-shaped recovery. Now, that's not unique. All recoveries are K-shaped recovery. There are always winners and losers. There are always ones leading and ones lagging. But the market isn't sure that some of these industries are ever coming back. Well, I guarantee you they are so totally coming back, and they're still waiting for you to buy those stocks.
And, David, what investment advice would you give?
Well, I'm in the camp of folks that will always want to be selective in equity exposure. I'm never really wanting to buy the whole entire market, and certainly not at a 25 times PE S&P and with a lot of expensive technology stuff out there. So we're selective. We like some of the consumer staples, good dividend growers with great balance sheets that are really not at all frothy or expensive. Frankly, there's still some underpriced energy stuff, and what people don't get is Biden's helping the big energy companies. What he's doing is killing the little guy. But the big Chevrons and Exxons all benefit from this kind of crony capitalism stuff he's doing. So we like that. If the yield curve is going to widen a bit more, there's no reason not to keep owning some of the financials. So the theme, I guess, I'd answer with, Larry, is selective, high-quality equity exposure that's mostly U.S.-centric. I still don't think you can go into Europe much, Japan. We like the U.S. a lot more.
Asia's strong, though, isn't it, gentlemen? China leading the way. China's VVV-shaped recovery.
You had Alibaba this week. They threw a $2.8 billion fine on them. So there is strong recovery there, but as far as getting that equity exposure, I still just have a hard time trusting communists. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, can we just agree on one thing, that you shouldn't buy equities in countries where there are no property rights?
Amen. Amen. Amen.
I'm fine with that. What about Japan?
Donald. Well, I'm finally finding a point of disagreement. On the principle that you want to find places where there's been less exuberance, where you're on the downstroke of the K and the upstroke of the K, the United States, because of the extraordinary amount of stimulus and relief that we've put out, just because of the resilience of our economy, and because we got the vaccine thing right, we're leading the pack in the recovery. So this is going to be a multi-speed recovery where the UK and the US lead it, and everybody else is struggling. So Europe, Japan, they're all going to be 3 months, 6 months behind. So consistent with my buy the laggards theme, that's what I'd do.
Dave Bunson, yes, of course, the vaccine is the most powerful stimulus because that's leading to the reopen of the entire economy. And that's the best supply side incentives we can muster. We're still operating under Trump rules, by the way. Biden wants to change them and reverse them. But we still have low taxes and we still have low minimal regulations and we still have a powerful energy sector. Whether any of that or all of it gets changed remains to be seen. But the other side, distinguished thinkers, many of them, will argue that it was the stimulus package, the $1.9 trillion stimulus package, and the stimulus package to be on infrastructure that's really going to prove conclusively that demand-side government spending works and that, in fact, tax hikes are not a problem. What are you going to say to that when people bring that up to you at various lunches and dinners and forums or even National Review Institute meetings?
Well, Larry, if you're asking me, what I'm going to say is that the stimulus program that was done a year ago was not a stimulus program. It was a relief program. Mm-hmm. This government made the mistake, like all world governments did, of causing an economic depression in the failed hope, as it turns out, of controlling coronavirus. So they created the depression. They had to pay everybody off. But, that wasn't a world of, industrial policy and government spending and everything. That was just giving unemployed people, the benefits they needed to put food on the table. So, that's fine. It's the stuff coming up that's so terrifying. Yep. I mean, my favorite meme of the week is, I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I call it infrastructure.
Oh, God, yes, I know. But you see, the favorite meme, David Bunson, that's going to be an important rallying cry. See, it worked. See, it worked. What worked? Top-down stimulus, big government spending, accompanied by tax hikes that won't really slow anything down. See, it worked. That's what the other team's going to say.
Right, and I think that they would say that anyways from a purely partisan standpoint. The amount of tribalism that has leaked over into economics just can't be allowed to get us down. I mean, people are always – look at what they've done with Operation Warp Speed, right? Well, see, that worked, but they don't want to give it credit. Mm. And then the idea of giving $1,400 to someone making $100,000 a year who was already employed, and they're going to say, see, that got Netflix's stock up? I mean, it's so dumb. It doesn't really require a response. However, I think on a macro basis, you've been fighting this battle for 30, 40 years. What we do – when people try to discredit supply side truths or whether they try to credit Keynesian components is we have to win the argument and just patiently and joyfully make the case. And there is no rational argument coming that this demand side frothy transfer payment creates economic growth. And if we have to go back to first things, that's what guys like Don and I and you will do. You can't create wealth by transferring it from one party to another We need to create wealth. We need high productivity. It's better for human dignity, and it's better for the economy.
You know, I love that, of course. I had, fellas, I had at the top of the show, former Ways and Means Chairman, now ranking Republican, Kevin Brady of the House. And he's a pretty determined fellow. And he's got the Republican staff, you know, cranking out a lot of memos almost on a daily basis, fighting the left-wing arguments and defending the achievements of the tax cut of 2017, which was, of course, administration, but it was also we had the House and we had the Senate as well, and he was a key factor. So they're pretty feisty. It looks to me like they're going to fight it, and they're going to fight the rhetoric too, Don Luskin. I think that's important.
Oh, it is. I mean, the Republicans have learned something from the Democrats over the last 4 years. It's just one word, resist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good, right. That's it. That's what I was striving for. You're exactly right. Resist. I love that. Resist. I wouldn't mind seeing a little, I'm always a congenital bull, everybody knows that, but I wouldn't mind seeing a little stock market revolt against high taxes. Just wouldn't mind seeing it, Dave Bonson.
Yeah.
Just saying, you know.
No, I wouldn't either, but you know what?
Stock market vigilantes.
Yeah, no, and I think you might get it, but we have to actually see them have the guts to come out and say what they're going to do. And that has to come from Biden. It has to come from Ron Klain. It has to come from Jen in a press release. So all the people writing articles about what they're going to do, the stock market's not going to revolt against that. It's when they actually put pen to paper. And what did they do with infrastructure? He came out and said, we're doing this infrastructure bill and we're going to do corporate taxes. He didn't touch capital gains. He didn't touch LLCs. He didn't touch marginal rates.
That's coming. Yeah. That's coming.
He's breaking it up into a second thing.
Yes,
so
that's coming.
Comes,
and you're going to hate it.
We have to respond.
You're
going to
hate what's coming.
I just want Joe Manchin to hate it. I don't care if I hate it. I need Joe Manchin to hate it.
But ask yourself, why are they breaking it up like this? They're breaking it up because they believe that, you know, ordinary, stupid, sheep-like people who are just happy that Biden isn't Trump, they're going to let slip through big tax hikes on evil multinational corporations who aren't them, right? But when it comes time to tell people that your FICA wages are going to get uncapped, yeah, and all the other stuff that they're talking about doing, capital, you know, eliminating basis step up and all this stuff, now ordinary people are going to say, oh my God, this was a gun that was aimed at me, mm-hmm, just that big evil corporation. So look, they're never going to get there. They are prioritizing. They're trying their best to get through the stuff that they maybe can get through, and they're deferring till the honeymoon is over stuff that they probably just know they can't get through.
You know, class warfare is so yesterday. Class warfare is like so Soviet Union. It's so Das Kapital and Karl Marx, 1867. I just can't believe class warfare will win. It never does. You get a whack at it, and then it gets stuffed right back down again. I just can't. It's just so yesterday, class warfare. It's so boring. Telling people that they can't succeed, it's not good.
But see, that's why they've turned it. That's why they've taken all of those same dynamics and rebranded them the war against white supremacy. Because I don't know anybody in the upper classes who is, you know, ashamed of the money he's made with the sweat of his own back. But I know that, you know, there are a lot of good Americans who, you know, don't have a racist bone in their body and are so, you know, have so much moral rectitude that if somebody accuses them of being a racist, they'll at least stop and think about it because they don't want to be that, right? And so they've found something that is a guilt trip in a way that class warfare isn't. And it's very effective right now. It's a little scary. Somebody, it's very hard to stand up against, too.
David Bonson, can you elect a Republican governor in California?
No, we cannot. And I don't say that because I'm a doom and gloom guy or not up for the fight. I'm just being totally realistic on the demographics. Not only can we not do it, but all resources and money that goes into trying to do it right now will be wasted when they could be spent, you know, getting a, let's say, Florida Republican governor in the White House or something like that. I mean, at the end of the day, I want Gavin gone. I think it's been a disaster. Yet we know you're losing elections by 20%. Mm. When Bill Simon lost to Gray Davis, you remember this. Mm. I think you used to have Bill Simon on your show.
Yep.
He lost by 2%. Mm. And then we recalled Gray Davis with one of the world's biggest celebrities running against him, right? It's just a different deal now. And by the time these guys get to vote, a lot of the rage against Gavin will unfortunately have calmed down a little. Schools will be back open. You know, thanks to the Supreme Court today, churches are going to be back open. So, no, Gavin's not going to go anywhere, and the state is not ready for that change, but it will come. It's just going to take more time for the foolishness of these Democrat policies to play out.
All right, gentlemen. I appreciate very much David Bonson, Don Luskin. Great stuff. Folks, stay around. We're going to do some money in politics next. I'll be right back.